Good evening. The government admits it hasn't flattened the curve. The White House calls Black Lives Matter a symbol of hate. How a good kid who played violin was killed by cops in Colorado, and New York City's $1 billion resiliency pork barrel. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, July 2nd, 2020. British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell was arrested Thursday on charges she helped lure at least three girls, one as young as 14, to be sexually abused by the late financier Jeffrey Epstein. The 58-year-old Maxwell was arrested in Bradford, New Hampshire, where she was living on a wooded estate she purchased for $1 million last December. Among the accusations was the claim by Virginia Roberts Jeffrey that Maxwell arranged for her to have sex with Britain's Prince Andrew at her London townhouse. Andrew denied her story, and Maxwell said in a deposition that Jeffrey was totally lying. Jeffrey Epstein pleaded guilty to similar charges in state court in Florida in 2008. He spent about a year in jail. An agreement at the time barred prosecution of any co-conspirators, but Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan until he was fired last month, argued that federal prosecutors in New York were not bound by that agreement. And U.S. unemployment fell to 11% in June as the economy added nearly 5 million jobs. But while the jobless rate is down, it's still at Depression-era levels. The new data comes as some states that tried reopening from the coronavirus pandemic have experienced a resurgence of the disease. Today, New Jersey Democratic Representative Andy Kim questioned Admiral Brett Giroux, Assistant Secretary for Health at the Department of Health and Human Services.
Not flattening the curve right now. The curve is still going up.
Do you think we're headed in the right direction?
Right now, and I tried to nuance this a little bit, in many counties we are, in many states we are, in many states we aren't. As you know, four states are accounting for about 50% of our new cases, and they're very concerning to all in public
and with,
health.
With those states with increased cases, I often hear, and I've heard my colleagues here say this last time around, that the increase in the positive cases is due to increased testing. In your professional and expert assessment, does that account for the increase that we're seeing in those states?
There is no question that the more testing you get, the more you will uncover, but we do believe this is a real increase in cases because the percent positivities are going up. So this is real increases in cases.
You said today that you think we should be looking at the guidelines of the Opening Up America, so I was just looking it up here, and it said the satisfied before proceeding to phased comeback. It said cases, downward trajectory of documented cases within a 14-day period or downward trajectory of positive tests as a percent of the total tests within a 14-day period. Do you know how many states are fulfilling this standard right now?
So right now there's a lot of movement in the system, as you know. Some have drawn back certain activities and some have kept going. I do want to make the statement, if you let me, is that what we're really seeing, we have seen states reopen quickly and have had no cases. We've seen cases not reopen and have a lot of cases. We really do believe the current outbreak is primarily due to under 35s with a lot of gatherings, not appropriate protection like masks. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's important to reopen and we believe in the guidelines, but I think the weight of the evidence is guidelines are not, you know, the personal responsibility is really a key right now.
Admiral Brett Giroux, Assistant Secretary for Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. Meanwhile, confirmed infections soared to an all-time high of 50,700 per day in the U.S. The spike in cases has led California, Texas, Arizona, and Florida to clamp down again on public gatherings, eliminating some jobs for a second time. And layoffs are still rising as 1.4 million Americans applied for unemployment benefits last week, only a slight decline over the previous week. The Labor Department reported Americans who've permanently lost their jobs rose by 600,000 last month to nearly 3 million. Millions more Americans have depended on the government stimulus, including $1,200 checks and grants to small businesses, but extended unemployment payments end this month. Meanwhile, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio criticized protesters at an encampment at City Hall. The City Hall protesters are supporting the movement to defund the police. He says tussling with police degrades their effort. The Occupy City Hall camp continues despite fights that broke out with police earlier this week. But the mayor is sticking with his plans to paint the words Black Lives Matter on Fifth Avenue in front of the Trump Tower. earning a bitter attack from the White House. Trump press spokesperson Kayleigh McEnany got in a tussle with a reporter today, defending a Trump tweet that Black Lives Matter is a symbol of hate.
Why is the president calling Black Lives Matter a symbol of hate?
Well, what the president was noting is that that symbol, when you look at some of the things that have been chanted by Black Lives Matter, like pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon, that's not an acceptable phrase to paint on our streets. Look, he agrees that all Black Lives Matter, including that of Officer David Dorn, Patrick Underwood, two officers whose lives were tragically taken amid these riots, all Black Lives do matter. He agrees with that sentiment. But what he doesn't agree with is an organization that chants pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon about our police officers, our valiant heroes who are out on the street protecting us each and every day.
Americans of all races have protested in all 50 states around that phrase, Black Lives Matter. And the president is here calling it a symbol of hate.
He's talking about the organization. I would note to you that the greater New York BLM president has said, if this country doesn't give us what we want, that we will burn down the system. And I could be speaking literally. I'd call that a pretty hateful statement.
But Kelly,
yes,
he's talking about the organization in his tweet. He says
yes,
the words.
Ben.
He says the words.
Which,
Black Lives
what's
Matter.
What's the name of the organization again?
Black Lives Matter.
There you go. You just answered my question. Go ahead, Ben.
Kayleigh McEnany, White House press spokesperson. Meanwhile, we return to a story from Monday about a protest by dozens of violinists protesting the killing of 23-year-old black man in Aurora, Colorado by police last summer. The victim was a self-taught violinist. A similar protest had been held in Colorado. A police body camera caught the altercation that led to the killing of Elijah McClain. The video shows him begging for his life as he's put into a chokehold by three Aurora cops.
Vincent, no, I want you to be civil.
Grab your gun, dude.
Stop, dude.
Give us some more units. We're fighting them.
My name is Elijah McClain.
Yeah, that's bro. All I need to use carotid.
That's what I was doing. I was just going home. I'm an introvert and I'm different.
Don't get up, dude. It's not going to be good for you. I'm telling you right now.
He was put into a carotid. He did lose consciousness. He's throwing up right now and he's obviously on something. Yeah. We're going to have him transported. What's that?
None of the cops were disciplined. Recently, as the cases received more notoriety, they were put on desk jobs. An attorney for the family, Murray Newman, says the incident began when McClain was walking home alone, wearing a mask, when someone called the cops. The caller said no crime was being committed, but when police arrived, they assaulted McClain.
Elijah was on the ground. He was begging for his life. He was pleading. He was saying that he was Elijah McClain. He was just trying to go home. And you can hear in this absolutely gut-wrenching video as Elijah is saying, I don't do fighting. I don't have a gun. I don't even kill flies. I don't eat meat. I don't judge people. I mean, it is an absolutely heartbreaking video to listen to. As Elijah was on the ground with multiple officers on him and handcuffed, he began vomiting. Officers stood by joking and said, don't get that on me. And one who apparently believed that Elijah wasn't lying still enough as he was dying said, quit messing around or I'm going to bring in my dog to bite you. The lack of humanity, the callousness, just the brutality is overwhelmingly terrible.
Is this how Aurora police act?
Unfortunately, the Aurora Police Department has a long and sordid history of brutality and racism. And, you know, to remind listeners, this is the same department that escorted James Holmes, who had just shot multiple people in a movie theater and was very heavily armed, active shooter, but white, escorted him out of the theater with no problem whatsoever. So this is a very racist department. The Aurora Police Department just can't sink any lower. Last weekend, there was a violent vigil here, just as there was last weekend in New York's Washington Square Park. And the Aurora police came out in force in riot gear, deploying stormtroopers to deal with violinists against peaceful protesters and violinists who were simply having a vigil to honor the life of a dead young man.
Why are violinists and string instrument musicians so moved by this case?
Elijah was not just a peaceful person, but also a musician. He taught himself to play both the violin and the guitar. He would take his lunch breaks and go and play his violin for animals who were waiting to be adopted because he thought it soothed them if they were lonely. I mean, he was just an incredibly lovely young man who, with a peaceful soul, who liked to play music.
And what happened to the police officers involved? How many of them were there, and what happened to them eventually?
Three police officers went hands-on and tackled and inflicted all of this outrageous force against Elijah. None of those officers was disciplined even one iota. They were very temporarily placed on leave, paid leave during an investigation, and they all went back to work and just these days have recently been put on desk duty, not to protect the public from their brutality, but to protect them because the public is so outraged. The seven or so officers, including a sergeant who stood idly by and failed to intervene to protect Elijah, were also not disciplined. And that's remarkable because the sergeant even reported later that he was becoming increasingly concerned about Elijah's physical well-being, and yet he did nothing to stop his subordinate officers from continuing to torture Elijah. Likewise, the two medics who injected Elijah, even though they had absolutely no right to do so, with a massive dose of ketamine.
Why did they inject him with ketamine?
They had no legitimate legal reason to inject Elijah with ketamine. Elijah was handcuffed on the ground. He was totally restrained. He was under the weight of an officer on his topside who was shoving him down into a pool of his own vomit. Others were holding his legs. Elijah was doing nothing except for trying to breathe.
So what happens now?
After millions of signatures and an online petition and international media attention, the city of Aurora claimed that it had hired an independent prosecutor or an investigator. It took the media about 5 minutes to realize that the person that they claimed was their independent investigator was actually a police officer turned lawyer whose legal practice is defending police officers accused of using excessive force. Now, after all of this media attention, finally, the governor has stepped in and appointed the Colorado State Attorney General to do its own investigation and hopefully prosecution of the involved officers and medic. And we received notice yesterday for the first time that the Federal Department of Justice has also been looking at whether to do an investigation of this case. Such an investigation is long overdue. This department is rotten to the core. Just this week, it's come to light that a different set of Aurora police officers apparently went back to the scene of where they killed Elijah and apparently reenacted it and took photos because they thought it was just so darn funny.
Anything like that?
We're also preparing a federal civil rights action because, unfortunately, over the course of my more than 20 years as a civil rights lawyer, I know that I cannot trust the government to police. I can't trust district attorneys to police. I can't trust attorney generals to police. And we've already, through open records requests, to obtain video interviews of the involved officers where they describe the many outrageous different kinds of force that they used against Elijah. Even though he is begging for his life, he's doing absolutely nothing wrong. I mean, this is, I think, every parent's most horrible nightmare. As it turns out, Elijah was a perfect young man who had no prior experience with law enforcement. His very worst offense ever was one time going 9 miles per hour over the speed limit. There needs to be a truly independent, thorough investigation every single time, not just when it is a perfect person and not just when the media internationally declares that it is a horrifying event.
Civil rights attorney Murray Newman represents the McLean family. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The new city budget that passed the city council on Tuesday is one of the most controversial in recent history. Today, protesters hit cuts to the half-price MetroCard for low-income New Yorkers. The $100 million Fair Fares program was sliced by more than 60%. City Council Speaker Corey Johnson said a decline in subway and bus rides makes the program less important. But activists say the cut will affect 361,000 New Yorkers living below the poverty line. And the economic future of New York City was foremost on Mayor de Blasio's agenda today. He addressed a question from WBAI's Jillian Jonas, who wanted to know if the city will rethink its opposition to rezoning Chinatown to protect its working class, low-income community.
What I have felt up to now, and Jillian, again, whole different moment in history. I mean, we're going through a massive transformation as we speak. And I don't think we've all begun to even think about what it means. Again, this is like going through the Great Depression or the pandemic of the Spanish flu after World War I, but we're doing them simultaneously with a 1970s fiscal crisis thrown in. I mean, we're in the middle of a massive, painful, but transformative moment. I don't know what the future is going to look like. We're going to work to try and figure that out best. I don't think the gentrification patterns are going to be the same, but what we have focused on is building affordable housing. We've done rezonings with the goal of maximizing affordable housing because I believe ideologically that that is the way to protect the balance of this city, to make sure that working people can live here, to make sure it's a city for everyone. The free market, I always say, the free market had free reign in Bushwick, in Bed-Stuy, and a lot of other places, and really massive displacement occurred. Where we've been doing rezonings, we're able to strike a balance and ensure that affordable housing will be part of the future for the community as well. And some places we have put some restrictions in place for sure. So it's not like it's only been one way. In some places we have said this is a limit to growth that has to happen for sure. So I will look at the situation in Chinatown anew under the dynamics we're dealing with. But I still think we don't have enough of a sense of where we're going next. What I do know is whatever the future of New York City, we're going to have to protect affordable housing. We're going to have to build more affordable housing to keep this a city for everyone.
And as Mayor de Blasio, the Chinatown Working Group, a coalition of residents and business people, has been advocating for rezoning to stop the construction of four 70-story luxury high-rises along the East River in the Two Bridges neighborhood. Organizer Zixun Ning said in a statement what he calls de Blasio's racist agenda would drive up rent and real estate taxes, kicking out low-income families and destroying existing affordable housing. Ning adds the Chinatown Working Group zoning plan would facilitate truly affordable housing that reflects the income level of the neighborhood for Chinatown and the Lower East Side. And in another issue dividing residents of the Lower East Side, the city says it plans to go full steam ahead with plans to close East River Park so it can be raised by about 10 feet as part of the city's flood resiliency plan for the area. While the community board and some NYCHA residents strongly support the $1.45 billion project, many have organized to stop the city from cutting down 1,000 trees and closing much of the park for at least 3 years. The city's part of the project, $1 billion in capital funds, is the same as the recent cut to the NYPD budget. Harriet Hirshhorn is an independent filmmaker who lives on the Lower East Side.
It's a $1.45 billion project, and $1.1 billion of that money is coming from the city capital funds. And what would be really great is if that money were actually used to help the people of New York City, who are not going to be in very good shape. What they're saying to us is that they are on schedule. They're actually ahead of schedule. They plan to start having a presence in the park called the Early Package, which involves destroying the compost and replacing it with temporary lawn. And that is supposed to start, they'll have a presence on July 6th. They've got a contract with Pizzi Russo Landscaping Company, the same people who are burying the dead on Hart Island. And then for the rest of it, they're going to start walling off parts of the park in September, closing 60% of the park. And by November, they hope to start actually demolishing the park.
Is there anything going on with the lawsuit?
There's an alienation lawsuit, but our lawyer is a very busy person and has requested that to have a little more time. There's a lot of documentation that he has to review.
So the suit might not be in time to stop any action?
It won't be in time to stop what's happening in July, no. They moved that up. It was supposed to start on August 31st, and they moved it up to July 6th. So they sort of gave the community the impression that they were congratulating themselves, I guess, at the last presentation, that while the city was on pause, they weren't. And they're happy to be able to report that they were able to go ahead as planned.
Yeah, in terms of what's been happening with COVID and the budget and everything, what does this mean?
And I think it's pretty devastating news for the Lower East Side and the East Village. The Lower East Side was hit really hard by COVID, both economically and just physically. I mean, a lot of people were sick. And we're not going to come back by September. I mean, we're still going to be really struggling. I don't know if you've been in the park lately, but it's absolutely fuller than ever of all of the residents of the buildings that line the river, including a lot of NYCHA residents from Brooke and from Lillianwald. And people are out there and families and cooking and trying to maintain a social distance from other people not in their pod. You see a lot of people wearing masks, but the park is really filled full to capacity. So the idea of not having 100% of it open come the fall is a really scary prospect. And I think the other thing that's sort of frightening is the idea that we're supposed to be having a fairly active hurricane season. A lot of us are going to be asked to evacuate. And with COVID still here, nobody's going to be able to evacuate and be in a shelter and be at a safe distance from each other. It's just not going to be possible.
Isn't this project supposed to protect people from something like the hurricane season that's coming?
The damage that this project can do is far greater. Now with COVID, it seems even greater than what we first imagined. We already were aware of how damaging it would be to community in terms of our health without the 1,000 trees to clean the air and a lot of other factors with the contaminants that might be in the ground and stuff like that. But with COVID, it just seems a lot worse. Somehow, you just feel like you're under attack because whatever small thing there is that exists to make your life a tiny bit better is going to be destroyed. We were supposed to get a report at some point about the validity of interim flood protection, because there are a couple of places where interim flood protection could make a huge difference in protecting our neighborhoods from storm surge, at least. We never had a response from the city about that, unfortunately. There are other parts of the city that are definitely investing in interim flood protection measures, and that's really great. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen in our neighborhood. We don't know why. There are other kinds of infrastructure projects like this and flood protection projects that have received federal money. And I think all in all, there are 13 of them across the country that have asked the government to extend the deadline for when that money can be spent. And the ESCR is the one project that has not asked for that deadline to be extended.
Harriet Hirshhorn is an independent filmmaker who lives on the Lower East Side. In related news, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is predicting an above-normal hurricane season for the North Atlantic this year. The hurricane season runs from June 1st through November 30th. NOAA is predicting 6 to 10 hurricanes, including as many as 6 with speeds over 111 miles per hour. The last major hurricane to hit New York City was Sandy in October and November 2012. 53 people died, and economic losses for the city were estimated at $19 billion. And anger over the $88 billion New York City budget and a controversial $1 billion cut to the NYPD has advocates of defunding the police reeling. As City Hall protesters say they're not going anywhere, Mark Winston Griffith, spokesperson for Communities United for Police Reform and executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, says his group will not give up their struggle to remake policing in New York City.
For those of us who saw this as a historic opportunity to forward the conversation on defunding the police, in divesting from the police department and reinvesting it in programs and services and a new vision of safety and harm reduction in New York City, then I think it failed miserably. The idea was that we finally had an opportunity to not only just send a signal, but to significantly decrease the footprint of the police department, to reduce the headcount, to make sure that it was out of things like homeless services, education, social services, mental health services. And none of that was done. And so if you want to claim that there was money shifted around and the police department was somehow involved in that equation, okay, yeah, you can say that. But if you want to say that we have reduced the ability of the police department to do harm against black and brown people in New York City, then I would say that what just happened was nothing about that. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with it, actually. You know, do things that are convenient, that are politically expedient, and are going to be superficial, but you're not really standing in solidarity with me or the people who I count among my political family. I think it's particularly difficult to say in this moment because 3 months ago, we certainly could not have predicted the pandemic. We certainly could not have predicted the death of George Floyd. And we certainly could not have predicted the way people have responded and reacted to those things. I can tell you that for those of us who were involved in this last budget struggle, that in many ways, this is really the beginning. We've cracked open this idea around defunding the police. This is a conversation we've never been able to actively had in the public consciousness before. And so now that that is the case, the possibilities are endless as far as advancing that conversation and doing things on a policy front, on a communications front, on a street demonstration front that forward our goal. So I think you're going to see this campaign revving up. I also think you're going to see a backlash against it. What you're going to find is that in elections coming up in 2021, where you will stand on the issue is going to be used as a litmus test. It will help define where your progressive credentials are. And just as de Blasio sort of used police reform as a campaign idea that in many ways helped sweep him into office, people are going to be measured against what he did. Because I think that most of us recognize that he was not only ineffective when it came to police reform, but actively worked against the interests in many ways. And in his waning moments of his administration, we're just not expecting very much. And so anyone running for citywide office and for local office is going to have to show how far they're willing to go as far as starting to dismantle the harmful impacts of policing and the carceral system in this city.
Mark Winston Griffith is spokesperson for Communities United for Police Reform and executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center. Meanwhile, PBA President Pat Lynch cited the recent rise of shootings in the city in his criticism of the cuts. He said in a statement, the mayor and the city council have surrendered the city to lawlessness. Things won't improve until New Yorkers hold them responsible. And that's some of the news for Thursday, July 2nd, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry and Jillian Jonas. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
Select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI.